1952, you became established investigator of the American Heart Association. Mm-hmm. What did this provide for you?
It provided my salary completely. And it also gave the institution, I think, something like $1,000 for expenses.
Okay. So, in a sense, you were really independent at that particular point.
Well, it was kind of amusing how I happened to do this. I was at a meeting of the American Society of Biological Chemists, and Helen Wood, who was on the committee of the American Heart Association, the research committee, got up and told the audience that no biochemists were applying for this thing, and he didn't see why they shouldn't, and he encouraged people to apply for it. Well, I was very dissatisfied with my salary, which was very low. I got paid less than anyone in the department. And Corey was a very subtle man, and so I decided I would approach this subtly. And I went in and told him that I was thinking of applying for this thing, and I thought, well, if I say that, he'll realize I'm dissatisfied with my status. He said, that's a wonderful idea, and I applied for it, and I got it.
Okay.
I remember you had to be interviewed by someone. I was interviewed by a professor of medicine at the University of Iowa. And before I went, I asked Corey if he knew this man. So he said he didn't know him personally, but he'd asked the professor of medicine, and he did know him. And all he could tell me about him was that his father was a classicist, and they used to speak Latin at the dinner table.
It's right down your alley.
He did ask me why I wanted it. And I told him one of the reasons was that it was very flexible, that if my husband were to leave Washington University, I could take this with me. He liked that answer.
So essentially then you were independent of Corey's, although you continued to work.
Well, it didn't really make any difference.
It didn't really make much difference.
No.
Because you were really independent before that.
That's right. I had my own grants, you see.
Ah.
By that time, the NSF and NIH were...
Oh, okay.
See, in 1946, there was no NSF and there was no NIH.
So you were dependent on others for a salary, but by this time you...
Oh, I didn't pay my salary often. My salary was always paid by Corey. I don't know where he got the money, but I was independent as far as money for supplies and instruments and so on. Anything I wanted to buy, I think my first grant was $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
But I was supported by the NSF.
Mm-hmm.
Not I, but my research.
Yes, you were just mentioned that at that particular point you got fed up with PMR and you turned to NMR. What was your first introduction to NMR?
Well,
what made it particularly fascinating for you?
Well, I found out, for example, very early, I guess, I must have known this in about 1953 or 54, because I remember when I got this idea for looking at ATP, I was in England on sabbatical. When you're on sabbatical, you're very relaxed and you can...
Yes, you think about...
yes, all sorts of things that if you're running your own laboratory, you know, you're too busy to sometimes...
This is another sabbatical that Henry had, and you had gone with him to England?
No, there we both decided to pick a place where we both want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I inquired and from the American Heart if I could go, if they would pay me if I went on sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
And they said no one had requested it before. And so they were a wonderful outfit. They said, sure, go ahead. So I started that. I was the first one to do that, but other people did it after that. So there's no problem about my going. We decided to go to Oxford because I want to work in Krebs Laboratory, and Henry found Oxford as a congenial place for him to go. We both he wanted particularly to go to a place where he knew the language, so we went to England was the choice, and Oxford because I wanted to go there, and so did he. So it was all right. I mean, we...
I didn't realize you'd worked in Krebs Laboratories as well.
Oh, yes, Hans Krebs.
Nobelis.
Yes, oh, yes.
keeps the record clean.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I worked in his lab. I liked him. He liked me, too. We got on very well. Nice man. Too bad he died. Anyhow, they're all dead now. But let's see, what were we
talking about? So you decided you could look at ATP and ADP.
Oh, yes. You asked me how I...
That's right.
Yes. I heard about hydrocarbons, that in a saturated hydrocarbon, you could tell the difference between, let's say, hexane and heptane.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That each of those protons chemically shifted from each other. Well, I thought that was pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I, having gotten that into my head, I started thinking about why not look at the three phosphoruses of ATP. You see, one of the things I was interested in, since all of these enzymatic reactions required a divalent metal ion, which chelate of magnesium, of ATP, what was magnesium doing on ATP? In fact, this is in a discussion of a symposium I was at, it's in print, where Al Leninger asked me a question about it when I was presenting the manganese EPR stuff, I guess. Yeah, it was in, well, never mind. It was either in the book on phosphate metabolism, which was a McCollum-Pratt symposium, or it's in the book on mechanism of enzyme action, which was also a McCollum-Pratt symposium. Both of those are in print. But in any case, I was very interested in where the magnesium sat. What was the active substrate, in other words?
What was the
word? Active substrate. Was the magnesium ligand to all the phosphates, to two, and if so, which two, and so on. So I thought, ATP, the phosphoruses should all be different. If you can distinguish those in a hydrocarbon, the protons, these phosphoruses are quite different. One has a sugar on it, and the other is a terminal one. There's the one in between, which is an anhydride kind of thing. Well, anyhow, I decided that I wanted to look at that. That was in 1955 when I was on sabbatical. In 56 I came back. And nobody, at that time, nobody around had a commercial instrument. They had a home-built one in the chemistry department at Washington U. But it could only do protons. And it was unshielded, and it was so sensitive that the students showed me one day. They had something on the oscilloscope, a peak, and they took a pair of scissors and opened them, and the peak disappeared. They had changed the magnetic field enough to make that thing disappear. So,
was anyone else doing phosphorus at that particular time? I mean, what made you think you could even do phosphorus?
Well, it was known.
Okay, that was known.
It had to be. I mean,
yes,
it was
right,
a nucleus that had a spin of a half. You know.
Okay.
Probably it had been done. I'd have to look it up to see whether it had been done, but not by any biochemist, I assure you. I'm trying to remember what was known about phosphorus at that time.
I mean, it must have been done because at some point you had to get a probe. I don't suppose you designed it.
No. That's what I'm telling you. It was done. In fact, Varian had a probe for phosphorus. So I wrote to them in 1956. And they got all excited. They said, come on out. Well, by this time I had three children. They were all fairly young. And I just couldn't pick up and go out there. I said, well, I will one of these days. And I let it sort of put it on the back burner. Well, 2 years later, in 1958, and my husband was invited to be a visiting professor at Stanford for the summer quarter. I thought, here's my chance to work at Varian. So I wrote to them again in the spring and said, look, I'm coming out this summer. I would very much like to look at ATP and ADP and their metal complexes. Can I do it? Well, now they were very standoffish because in those 2 years, the organic chemists had discovered NMR, and they were selling instruments. And their applications laboratory was very busy showing people what you could do with it, you see. So in those 2 years, I had gotten such an enthusiastic reception the first time. The second time, they were very cool. They said, yes, I could probably manage to get on the machine. Well, I was going out there anyhow. So I went out there, and I guess I got there in June. And the first Sunday we were there, we were invited by some friends of ours. He was a physicist, and who should be there but Felix Bloch? And it was the social occasion, so I didn't say anything, but at one point in the afternoon, Felix Bloch said to me, and what are you planning to do this summer, to me? I said, well, I was hoping to do some NMR at Variant. He said, oh, he said, I'm going out there tomorrow. Would you like to come with me? Well, you know, it was like being asked by God in the NMR field whether you want to go with him. I said, sure. So he himself took me out there, and even half of the people at that time who were doing research at Variant on NMR were his former students. He was a consultant.
He's a consultant at...
Yes, he was a consultant at Variant. That's why he went out there once a week or whatever. I don't know how. Anyhow, he introduced me to the requisite people. And in spite of that, I got 2 days in the whole summer on the instrument. Now, one of the reasons was I looked at the proton NMR of ATP, AMP, and ADP. The ribose end is very crowded, the ribose part of it, but the adenine only has two protons on it there, off there by themselves. Mm-hmm. And actually, Jadecki, I don't remember when he published it, but he published the proton spectrum of the nucleotides. I don't remember what year that was. I'd have to look it up. But anyhow, I wasn't really interested in that. I just wanted to see what one could see. I was interested in the phosphorus. And you see, the reason that it took so long to get to it is that they didn't want to put the phosphorus probe in.
Yes.
So finally, one day during the summer, they did it, and they called me, and they said I could come and use it. And I did, and there I saw the three peaks of ATP. Mm-hmm. So I knew the problem was doable.
They were splitting one another, too.
Yeah, but I don't think I could see that at that time.
Okay.
But I did see three peaks.
Mm-hmm.
And I put in magnesium, and I could see that effect, too, that changed the chemical shift.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put in manganese, and, of course, I obliterated the spectrum. That's all. By the way, I was using 1 molar ATP at that time. I don't think anyone had ever made a 1 molar magnesium ATP solution before. It was kind of viscous. So I found out that I didn't have a problem anyhow. And when I got back to St. Louis, I talked to my friends, and I found out that at the University of Illinois, they had just bought, Varian had just started selling commercial 60 megahertz instruments. And they had one at Illinois, which was in Urbana. And so I inquired whether I could use it. And they finally decided to let me use it on weekends. They had a technician who ran it, and I had to pay him. Well, that was all right with me. Once a month or something like that, I could come up there and use it. And so that's how it started. And then, in the meantime, NIH invited Sam Weissman to put in a proposal for an NMR instrument. And so Sam said, why don't you come in on this grant? And he asked me to write something up. And the idea was that I would have 1 week a month on it. I was responsible for 25% of the proposal. So after I had been driving myself up and once took the train, that was altogether crazy, to Illinois.
You know how far it is from St. Louis to Urbana?
I really don't know. I think about 150 miles, maybe. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not important.
Yeah,
I just wondered how long it was taking you to...
Oh, it was... it's probably more than 150 miles, because it used to take me a good bit of time to do this. I don't remember exactly. But maybe 200 miles, something like that. Anyhow, I used to do this on weekends. And then when I heard we were getting one, I stopped going up there. When I published the first paper, I wanted to acknowledge their use of their instrument, you see. They didn't want me to. They didn't want anyone to know that they had allowed an outsider to use it. So they were never acknowledged. I can acknowledge them now. They were very nice to let me do that. So then we got our own. And it took months to get it to work because Varian did not have a temperature control on it. And they were used to Palo Alto, where the temperature is pretty constant. In St. Louis, the temperature could drop 40 degrees in a day. And so it was impossible to run this thing without a temperature control. Mm-hmm. And they had given the job of taking care of this instrument to this fellow Tom Hughes, with whom I published the papers. Yeah. He was a graduate student in physics who had overstayed his welcome in the physics department. They would only support you for 7 years, and he hadn't gotten his degree yet. Mm-hmm. So he had to take this job in order to support himself while he...
I see. That's who Tom Hughes is.
Yes. He was a graduate student, and he was a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. He didn't like women either. Everything had to be perfect, but he was a very good mm-hmm. person. He really, when he finally started turning out spectra, they were superb. Nobody else could do it. He used a certain trick of putting all the power in the sidebands. Well, anyhow, that's a technical thing, but he figured it out. And he really got a beautiful spectra. At that time, 5mm tubes were all you could use and spin. That's so you could only get a high resolution spectrum on a 5mm sample. And also, there was no way of averaging, so you had to do it in a single scan. You see?
Oh, yes. If that was long before either CAT scans or
that came later.
Right,
at that time, you had to do it in a single scan.
Right.
So to get a high-resolution spectrum of ATP, the phosphorus of ATP, I had to use half molar, 500 millimolar. And I got a beautiful spectrum with all the coupling constants and so on. And I did the pH dependence of the shifts. I did ADP and ATP, and I did the pH dependence. That was the first paper.
The way you told which one was the gamma phosphorus was just because that was the one that was shifting with in acid.
That's right.
Okay.
And the beta, of course, you could distinguish.
That.
Yeah, the coupling constants, as it turned out, were the same for alpha and gamma, which was a little surprising because I thought there might be an effect of the adenine or the adenosine on it, but there isn't. They're the same. That is, the beta alpha and the beta gamma are the same, the coupling constants.
They almost should be, shouldn't they? Because they're... Oh, I see.
One of them is an ester.
Right.
The other one is
right.
just a phosphate.
Yeah.
In other words, that ester moiety doesn't influence
yeah.
the coupling constant. Now, the shift, of course, is... They overlap at low pH. The alpha and the gamma, but as you make it alkaline, it starts moving. And then I did the next paper. I did the magnesium, zinc, and what else? Calcium effects on the shift.
Okay.
I also did the proton NMR to see what effects these things, either pH. It always bothered me the fact that when you put on a proton on the gamma phosphate, it moves in one direction, but when you put on a magnesium, it moves in the other direction.
Now, the one with the metals, that do you think is your most cited paper?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, because, well, that's obviously sort of fundamental to...
Well, you see, they've used it now to determine the magnesium concentration in vivo. They look at the ATP, and they can tell whether it's saturated or not. You see, and if it isn't saturated, they can tell how much free there is.
Oh, okay, by the
shift.
I see. Okay.
See, the beta shifts a great deal.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
You got a bonus there.
Yeah, well, I didn't do that. Someone else did it later, of using it that way. But I was concerned. Oh, by the way, I first reported this effect, again, on the question of the metal ion, effect of metal ions on ATP as a substrate, in a paper in 1959, a symposium paper. And by the way, you should look at that to see who were the discussants. Everyone from Ron Breslau to Todd. No. It was a very interesting symposium, actually. It was held at Gatlinburg. And in that paper, 59, probably 20 years later, I was at a meeting where three different people showed a figure from that paper.
That's rewarding.
Yes.
In 1958, you were appointed associate professor at Washington University. Mm-hmm. So this was your first line appointment.
That's right. My first faculty position.
How did that come about?
Well, what happened was that in 1957, let's see, when was I first an established investigator?
In 1952.
Yeah. It was a five-year thing. And, however, when I first got it, it was renewable. But then the American Heart discovered that the people who were their established investigators weren't getting appointments because the departments knew they could keep them for 10 years on this thing. And so they limited it to 5 years. So by the time I applied for the renewal, they had changed the rules. But I felt they couldn't really make it retroactive. They could, of course, but I tried anyhow. So they wrote to me and told me that they really didn't like to do this, but since I had no appointment, they would do this. But would I ask the chairman of my department what his intentions were? So I came in and showed Corey the letter. And he said, Mildred, as soon as there is an opening, a slot, you will get it. So I wrote that to them, and they were satisfied with that, and they renewed it. So in 1958, there was a slot, I suppose, and I was appointed an associate professor.
Okay, Corey could make those decisions on his own. He didn't have to go, or he had enough power around to...
Oh, he was one of the triumvirate that ran that school.
Mm-hmm.
The three calls. Yes, the three calls, as they said. Because one was Carl Moore, who was the professor of medicine.
Say, Malter?
Moore.
Moore, okay.
Who was the professor of medicine. The other call, who was that? Maybe it was... I don't know who the other third call was, but there were three that were very important professors in the medical school.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Corey had very good judgment of people. He was fantastic when it came to judging people. I remember he once interviewed a prospective graduate student whom he then asked me to talk with him, and afterwards he told me exactly what kind of career this fellow would have, and he was right, absolutely right. This was when he applied to graduate school. It was someone who had an MD degree already, but even so, it was a remarkably astute kind of... I always felt that, you know, that he would have done well in the Habsburg court, you know, that fine Italian hand and so on. But anyhow, that's what he said, and he kept his word. The next year, I was given an appointment. The American Heart was really wonderful. They had already budgeted for that year, for my salary. So they gave me the money for research instead, which was very nice of them.
Interesting, you in that second paper, the one that you did with the metals, you comment that you thought that the use of paramagnetic ions would be very promising, and obviously it was very promising for you.
Well, it's still promising. They're thinking of using them. In fact, people have used them as contrast agents for imaging, because they have such an effect on the water resonance, you see, on the protons of water, that if they are preferentially absorbed one place or another and retained, then you'll get a very good contrast. It changes the T1 and the T2 so tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they use in imaging, the T1 and T2 of water.
We'll get to your work there. Essentially, you've been doing that for all through the 60s. You were doing
that's right.
the same kind of...
Well, what happened was that I decided that NMR wasn't much use to me because of the tremendous concentrations you had to use.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did get down to 90 millimolar when I used a 12 millimeter tube, which couldn't be spun at that time, so it was low resolution. But even 90 millimolar is very high for enzymatic work. And this was before there were any CAT scanners, or, you know, not CAT scanners, what do they call it? They called it the CAT.
The CAT,
yes.
Right. Okay.
It was the computer of average transients is what it was.
Right.
That came later. But I decided, again, that this was very interesting chemistry, but for biochemistry, at the moment, it wasn't very useful. Not that I forgot about it, but I figured it would get more sensitive, the instrumentation would get more sensitive as time went on, but it was a waste of time to try to do anything at this point.
Suddenly something became clear as to why there was now this 10-year transition, and then you took up NMR again in the 70s.
That's right.
I see, okay.
Now, the one thing that there's plenty of in an enzymatic system is water. So I decided to work with water. And since I've always and still do believe that one of the most fruitful things is to look at interactions of electron spin and nucleus spin, or nucleus spin and nucleus spin, I decided to use manganese, which was already I knew would work instead of magnesium in all these systems. And so I started looking at the effect of manganese on the T1 and T2 of water with various things attached to the manganese. Now, my original naive idea was that I could tell how many water ligands were left on the manganese. I didn't think it would have any other effect than, of course, the effect of the manganese is proportional to the number of the waters in the first coordination sphere of the manganese. So, in this way, if I put manganese on ATP and there were three phosphates, I could tell the difference between that and if there were two phosphates, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out, of course, that as soon as I started looking at an enzyme in the presence of manganese, ATP, that there was a fantastic change in the relaxation times that could not be explained, even if you went from... in fact, it got bigger instead of smaller, the effect. Now, that couldn't be due to the number of waters, obviously, because that would go in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
The effect would get smaller, not bigger. And so then I knew I had a very interesting phenomenon.